Mecca, Saturday, September 12th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we've got a ginormous show for you today. It's because this is my, I don't want to call it a wrap-up, because I think you've probably already heard a lot of the stuff that was announced on Wednesday at Apple's Hey Siri, Give Us a Hint event. But those of you who have been listening to the MacCast for a while know that one of the things that I like to do after these events is there's the event itself, right? And at the event, there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of marketing terms being thrown around. There's a lot of stuff that comes out of it. And every time I finish one of these events, or most of the time when I finish one of these events, and I don't know if you're the same way, I come out feeling like, wow, that was amazing. What a bunch of amazing stuff. I want everything that they announced. It's all awesome. It's all great. And it's because Apple crafts it that way. They craft it so that, you know, we get excited and jazzed about this stuff. It's what we've always called the reality distortion field. And it was often attributed to Steve Jobs, but I think it's just Apple in general. They do a great job of making this stuff drool-worthy. You know, the pacing, everything is set up. And this event, this time around, was one of the better ones that they've ever done this with. And so coming right off of it, and if you caught me, I was on Twit right afterwards, and I was on the Daily Tech News Show with Tom Merritt and Scott Johnston. If you saw either of those things, or if you've heard me talk a little bit, because I've done a few things since then, you kind of know this happens, right? There's not a lot of answers to questions. So you that's the other thing coming out of the event, right? You have a lot of questions like, what just happened? What about A, B, and C? And you don't think of those in the moment, right? Because you're caught up in the moment. But almost immediately afterward, in the hours or days afterwards, you're like, hey, yeah, but what about this? And what about that? All these questions start to come to mind. And when you're talking about it right after the event, you really don't have those answers. So those start to come out in the days following. So what I really like to do in these episodes is dig deeper and try and get all of the information for you, all the specs, all the answers, so that once you finish this episode of the MacCast, you'll know everything about all the new products, or at least everything that we know to date. And to that end, what I've been doing in these last couple of days, and it's actually taken me longer this time around because I think there's been more articles and more stuff written about this event because there was more products announced. It was just a bigger event. So I've parsed through thousands, literally, I think, thousands of articles at this point, and read literally hundreds, probably 150, maybe even 200 articles that I've read through to put together the show notes for today's show. So needless to say, we have everything about all the new stuff that Apple announced. We are going to get into all of it. A little bit of feedback. This is going to be probably a pretty long show. So we do have a little bit of feedback from you from prior episodes. And then another question I've been getting asked, because we're right on the verge of getting a new version of the operating system. Several of you asked this week if I could run down clean installing OS X. Specifically, this is going to be crafted towards OS X El Capitan. And so I'm going to dive in and do that as well, because it has been a while since we've actually covered clean installing the operating system. So it's going to be a great show. Hang in with me. But before we get into all of it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, for almost anything that you do these days, you probably end up needing to build a website at some point for a lot of things. You've got a club or a group or an organization you're in, website, right? You're coaching your kids' sports team, they want a website. Maybe you're starting a small business, or you run a business on the side, you want to sell some things, website. You think you have the cutest pet in the whole wide world and you want to make a blog, website, right? This comes up over and over again, but not everybody is a programmer, and if you're not, what are you going to do? Well, you could learn code, you're smart, you know, but really, who has the time to do that? Or you could hire someone, yeah, but that could get costly, and you might not get exactly what you want. And that's exactly where Squarespace comes in. I mean, heck, I am a web developer. I program for a living, and I've used Squarespace on several of my projects, and that's because their sites look great. They have all the features you could want or need. You can get them up very quickly, and their pricing plans are super affordable and include everything, whole front to end. You got your hosting, your domain, your website design, all of the features, they're all in there, and there's no coding required. And what I appreciate as a developer is that if you want to dig in deeper, if you want to get a more custom look, if you want to do things outside of the templates, you can get in there and you can code as well. So it's not limiting in any way, shape, or form. And you can go simple or as complex as you need. You can set up just a simple single page site. They have a new feature called cover pages that are great for that. And if you need more, they've got e-commerce, they've got galleries, blogs, maps, social media, all the stuff you need, all the tools are in there, and they're easy to use, easy to set up, and pricing starts at just $8 a month. And with that, you can get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So you don't have to take my word for it. You can try it out completely free. You can start your free trial today. No credit card required. All you have to do is go to squarespace.com/maccast. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, just make sure you use the offer code MACCAST when you're signing up, and you will get 10% off your first purchase. So really nothing to lose. You need to build a website. You need to make it great, and you need it done quickly. Check out Squarespace. Squarespace, build it beautiful. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So here we go. We are going to dive in, and I'm going to do a little reversal of the event. If you haven't caught it, Apple has put up the entire keynote. You can get it on your Apple TV. You can get it through the Apple.com website. You can view everything right from the horse's mouth. But spoiler alert, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the order that they did things in. So I guess just running down the announcements, because you probably already know what these are. They talked a little bit about the Apple Watch, and then they did the iPad Pro and followed that with the Apple TV. I think I'm getting this order right. And then the iPhones, the new iPhones, the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. And in my opinion, the biggest announcement was the one that came the earliest, well, I guess right after the Apple Watch stuff, which was the iPad Pro. And I think they really should have saved that for last. So I'm not going to do a real big analysis of the keynote other than to say, like I said already, awesome keynote. I think the pacing, everything was really great until they kind of got to the end. I think the iPhone portion drug on a little bit longer than it should have. I think it took up like 40 minutes of the keynote, and the entire keynote was 2 hours and 20 minutes, I think, with the musical guest. And I think they could have shortened that up because they covered some of the technologies, and we're going to get into those things like the 3D touch, but I don't think they needed to go quite into that much detail. So my analysis there was the keynote felt a little long, especially on the tail end, but otherwise I think the pacing was great. And then the only other critique I have is I would have put the iPad Pro, which I think was the biggest announcement, at the end for the most impact. I think a lot of people already had kind of heard the rumors about the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. Yes, we had heard rumors about the iPad Pro, but I think there was a lot more in here, as you'll see when we get into this stuff. And I'll talk more about my impressions as we talk over each individual thing. So starting off with Apple Watch updates, really just some updates to the Apple Watch. Not a ton of stuff here, but some significant updates. The new Hermes leather editions of the Apple Watch are coming out. These are in partnership with a French company. They're going to have a double tour, what's called a double tour design, which it was that wraparound. It's a double wraparound leather strap. And then they also have a classic buckle version and then a big cuff version. These are stainless steel versions of the Apple Watch. They are going to cost between US $1,100 and $1,500. And those are going to be available soon in the Apple retail store. So you'll be able to pick up that version. They announced a bunch of new sport bands and colors, like we talked about, and options, including now you can finally get the Space Black stainless steel version, with a black sport band, so you don't have to go all the way up to the, what was it, $1,100 model just to get the space black color. You have a new option there. And the new sport bands come in some darker colors, including a product red version. There's a nice navy blue version. And then they also have some more kind of muted pastel kinds of colors, like a pink and a beige and a lighter blue and those sorts of things. And those are going to be available for $49, just like all of the other sport bands. And then they did announce two new sport finishes, or aluminum finishes, in a gold and a rose gold aluminum sport watch. Those starting at the same sport watch pricing of $349. And so I thought some nice updates here, but nothing really major. Nothing that is going to, knock your socks off, although it's nice to have the gold and rose gold colors to sort of match your other devices. So if you want to match your iPhone to your Apple Watch, you can pretty easily do that now. And so, speaking of iPhones, that's the next thing I want to cover. I think Apple should have covered that next. We did get the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. As far as specs go, the sizes are remaining exactly the same, just slightly thicker, between 0.1 and 0.2 millimeters thicker, depending upon the model. They are using the 7000 series aluminum, just like the Apple Watch. So a lot of focus was given to the fact that these are now stronger, both in terms of the aluminum. They're also using a new dual ion exchange glass that is also just a little bit thicker. And that does mean, one of the questions that immediately came up is, am I going to be able to use my old iPhone 6S, or 6 rather, or 6 Plus case? And I would think in some cases, maybe. It's really going to depend on the tolerance of your case. If you have a really tight fitting case, because there is a little bit additional thickness, it might not fit if you're looking to upgrade. So you may need to get a new case in that case. but the screen resolutions are the same. Nothing has changed there. Internally, you've got the new A9 processor along with the M9 motion coprocessor. And there's some cool things here. The A9, Apple claims, is about 70% faster for CPU and 90% faster on the GPU. So really a graphics powerhouse. And a nice addition with the M9 motion coprocessor is it's going to let you now use the Siri command, the automatic Siri command. I'm trying to avoid saying that phrase. We call it Hola Siri on the iOS show. That thing that you'll say to wake up Siri and get her to listen to you if you're plugged in right now with your iPhone, you're no longer going to have to be plugged in to use that feature. So you'll be able to say Hola Siri and not be plugged in with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. And there are some indications that in iOS 9, because one of the concerns is going to be, well, you know, what happens if people are just being mean and in the background start saying Hola Siri and they're doing stuff on my phone? There's some hints in OS 9, which will be out on September 16th and available to the public, that when you set up Siri now, you'll be able to train her to your voice. So she'll be able to better recognize, I would assume, just your voice. And that means that when you're using that feature, it won't accidentally go off on your phone if it doesn't recognize that you're the one giving the command, which is a really nice thing. And immediately after this feature sort of got announced, a big question that came up is, what about privacy? If Siri's always on and listening when I have my phone running, you know, what's going to happen is Apple, because many of us know that the way Apple processes Siri data is to send it up to its servers. So the question was, you know, is Apple capturing this data? Are they going to be storing stuff on their servers? I really don't want them to. Well, Apple came out and addressed that issue. They responded to it. They are not going to be actually sending any of the data or saving any of the data until you've said those magic words. And at that point, the command gets sent. So yes, it is listening. There's a small buffer, but it's just in memory and it's constantly being cycled. So it's sort of listening and then moving on. It's not storing that data or information on the phone, and it's not sending that information to Apple until it needs to when you're actually trying to use a Siri command. So your fears can be put to rest there, at least if you want to take Apple's word for it. Storage sizes on the new phones are the same as well. So you're starting out at the 16 gigabyte model. I know it's still around. I've talked to a lot of people about this, and the general consensus is that the 16 gigabyte is really targeted at the enterprise that buys large volumes of phones. They're probably putting enterprise-only apps on there, so they have very specific needs. They don't let their workers actually install their own apps or put their own photos on it. You know, it's those types of environments that Apple really sells that device into, and that's their highest profit margin in terms of the memory chips are cheaper to get. It's, you know, the component costs are lower and they make a healthy profit on that. So that model is probably going to stay around for a while. And then you have the jump up to 64 gigs or 128 gigabytes. And that's across all of the models. And I would say, you know, if you're looking at an iPhone, I wouldn't even look at the 16 gigabyte model. And this is another argument that people make, is that Apple is doing that also to kind of push people to spend the extra $100 and jump up to the 64 gigabyte model. And I really do think it's your best value. I think most people I know who've opted for the 16 gigabyte model at some point discover that they don't have enough storage. Now, there are some things happening in iOS 9 to better mitigate that stuff, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I still think 64 gigabytes at a minimum is the way to go for probably 80% of the people buying iPhones. Some really nice updates to the camera system: a 12 megapixel sensor on the EyeSight camera and a 5 megapixel on the FaceTime camera. That's a huge leap on the FaceTime camera because the current version has just a 1.2 megapixel camera. Optical image stabilization is still a feature that's only in the iPhone 6S Plus, so still only on the Plus models. The camera will now allow you to shoot 4K video at 30 frames per second. So not high frame rate 4K video, but 4K video nonetheless. So that's a bump up from the 1080p. And with the FaceTime camera, you're now getting a Retina FaceTime flash, or True Tone flash, rather. And Apple's doing this in a really clever way. When I first heard about the rumor that Apple might put a front-facing flash on the camera, I thought, well, that would be awful, because I was picturing the same kind of flash we have for EyeSight. No, they're doing it a little bit differently. So what they're using is they're using the screen, actually, on your iPhone to create the True Tone flash. And so they're analyzing that. They're adjusting the color of the white that's going to go up when the flash goes off. And it kind of happens in three little bursts, I guess. And there's different stages, and it adjusts the color and everything like that. And Apple even tweaked the ability in the controller to make the light on the screen just for that brief second when the flash is going up to three times brighter. And from the hands-on people and the reports that I read, they say it actually works surprisingly well. So if you do a lot of selfies, probably especially late at night at the clubs, maybe. I'm not into that. I'm an old fogey. I don't do that kind of thing anymore. But you kids who do that, you're going to have much better selfies now in low light, thanks to the higher megapixel camera and also the new Retina True Tone flash on the that goes along with the FaceTime camera. Also on the new iPhone, Touch ID 2, which is said to be twice as fast as the current Touch ID. So I have a feeling your phone's going to kind of open up faster. Maybe before you even think about doing it, before you even get your thumb on the sensor, Touch ID is going to kick in. And I'm only saying that because I've never been really displeased with the speed of the current Touch ID. But I guess anything that makes it faster, more reliable is a good thing. So I look forward to trying that out. But I think it's going to be really amazing. There is a slightly smaller battery in this version of the iPhone, 1,715 milliamp hours in the iPhone 6S compared to 1810, which was the size of the battery in the 6. And that's probably because it's making room for the Taptic engine. This phone does have a Taptic engine. It's there mainly to support the 3D touch, and we're going to talk about that here in a second as well. But just finishing off the hardware, you got the Taptic engine. Oh, on the battery, you will get the same battery life. So one concern was smaller battery, maybe less battery life on these versions of the phone. According to Apple, you're still getting the same battery life. So they've obviously made some tweaks in other areas to make sure You get the full battery performance out of it. And then on the wireless side of things, you've got 802.11ac, Bluetooth 4.2, and the new faster LTE that we had been hearing about, up to 300 megabits per second, of course. And that's going to be dependent upon your carrier. As far as how pricing works out, it's a little bit different this year. One thing to note, if you're a U.S. consumer and you want to get a phone on contract with AT&T, you have to go directly through AT&T. It looks like you can still get on contract pricing through the Apple Store on Verizon. I think T-Mobile doesn't do that, and I don't know about Sprint, but just note that. Pricing on the iPhones, the iPhone 6S is the 16 gigabyte model, US, and these are all US prices, $199, 64 gigabytes, $299, and $128, $399. That would be on a two-year contract. The off-contract pricing for the iPhone 6S, 16 gigabytes is $649, 64 gigabytes, $749, and $128, $849. And then for the Plus models, $299, $399, and $499 for the 16, 64, and $128 respectively on contract, and $749, $849, and $949 for the iPhone 6S Plus without a contract. So that's kind of how the pricing breaks down normally. Now, most people are probably going to opt in for either their carrier's payment plan, or now a new thing this year that Apple announced is they are doing their own upgrade program, the Apple iPhone Upgrade Program. And this is really for people who like the idea of being able to get a new iPhone every year and don't really mind not really owning your phone. Because basically under this plan, you're in essence renting the phone. I guess in some ways you could be deferring the payment because you do have an option to kind of pay it off at some point. But I think the idea here is most people are going to get on the payment plan, and then the next year they will trade back the phone that they have to Apple and then start a new payment plan on the new phone. So you're constantly paying a monthly fee. Now, the one advantage of this in going through Apple is Apple's going to sell you a fully unlocked device. You still needed to choose a carrier, but it does come out of the box unlocked. So if you're international, you travel, this might be a good option for you as well. The Sprint and Verizon versions, just so you know, are still different models. So just be aware of that if you're picking your carrier. And be aware of that if you're going to be planning on going between networks or something like that. You probably want to check Apple's tech specs on the website for, you know, the carrier bands that are supported and stuff like that across the different models. We won't go into them here because there's far too many of them. But if you want to get on Apple's upgrade program, the way it works is it starts at $32.41 a month, U.S. It does include AppleCare, so that's another advantage. To the advantage over probably your carrier's payment plan is you're going to get AppleCare Plus, and again, you're dealing with Apple, and you're not going having to go through the carrier. And so, as an example of what this might be like, say you wanted to get the 64 gigabyte iPhone 6S. You're going to be paying $36.58 per month for 24 months for a total payout of $877.92 by the time you've made those 24 payments. Now, that's on a phone that costs $749 if you were to buy it outright, plus the AppleCare, which that has gone up in price. AppleCare now costs $129 on the new models. So that's up $30 from the $99 price. So you add all that in, and you're basically getting a zero-interest loan from Apple. But again, remember, you don't own the phone. So if in a year you want to go in and get the iPhone 7, you have to have kept your phone in good condition, and then you have to trade it back into Apple and then start up a new plan. Now, you could again, pay off the 12 additional payments at, you know, what did I say that was, $36.58. So that works out to $438, and then you would own the phone, and you'd be able to, I assume, go resell it. But you're basically selling it back to Apple for about that price, and they're covering the cost, and that lets you keep going. So that's kind of how that program works. You do have to pass a credit check. So you do have to go in-store. You have to make an in-store appointment if you want to choose Apple's payment plan, and they're going to check you all out. You got to schedule it, go in, and you can do that through the website, but you're not going to be able to order it online under that program. Now, you can order it under the different carrier programs through Apple's website, And they all have different payment systems. Check with your carrier. Prices will vary. Again, I don't want to get that deep into it in this episode because everybody kind of has a different way that they're doing it. I will just tell you, in my opinion, I'm at a stage in my life where I really don't like renting stuff anymore. And I know it fits for a lot of people. This is just personally for me. I want to just buy my phone. So this time around, I am just buying the phone outright, not going on a carrier contract, and then I will have, you know, the option to upgrade when next year comes around. It's a more costly way to go up front, but on the back end, I have a device that I can own, and if I've kept it in good condition, iPhones really retain their value, and especially if you have them unlocked. So I can go to my carrier and have the device unlocked, and like, for example, an unlocked iPhone 6S Plus, my 128 model, is going for $600 or more on eBay, $600, $700, something in that range. So I could turn around and sell it. I have the option. In my family, they generally get handed down at this point. So, you know, we're going to keep them in the family. But you get the point, right? It's just a different way of sort of handling and subsidizing your phone. Do you want to pay month to month in little installments, or do you want to kind of just pay everything up front and then make it up later on the back end? It's really up to you, and it's just kind of two different philosophies of how you do this stuff. Apple is going to continue to sell the iPhone 6 and the 6 Plus. They're getting rid of a couple different models, though. There's going to be no gold version of those models and no 128 gigabyte options. So your options are going to be silver or space gray in 16 gigabytes or 64 gigabyte sizes. The iPhone 6 is going to start at $99 US, and the iPhone 6 Plus is going to start at $199, and those are both with contract pricing. I didn't get the off-contract pricing for those, but that's sort of how Apple's doing up the lineup. And then the free phone, Apple is getting rid of the iPhone 5C. We did not get any announcement of a 6C yet. I guess it could still come sometime next year. But for now, the kind of free on-contract phone is going to be the iPhone 5S. So your options for iPhones across the whole line now are going to be iPhone 5S at the bottom end, and then you have the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus models, and then the 6S and the 6S Plus working its way up. And that's the full Apple lineup. Now, a couple key new features that were shown off with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus, and these are exclusive to that model. A lot of people had wondered, you know, specifically with the feature called Live Photos, if that would be available on older iPhones. No, this is all stuff that's tied into the new hardware. So if you want these features, you do have to get a new iPhone. But Apple announced 3D Touch, which is and looked very much to me like Force Touch, where you can press on the screen, and the more you press, different sort of actions would happen. And so one of the questions that came out of the event was, well, what's going on here? What's really different? And one answer is that it's different in how it kind of detects the force that you're using. For 3D Touch, it's actually using light from the LED, from the LED backlight or the LEDs, to detect minute differences in pressure applied to the glass. So the glass, when you're pushing on it, flexes in, you know, microscopic amounts, but they've tuned the system and they've set up sensors with 3D Touch to detect that, and it can tell how much force you're applying to different areas of the screen. And for the most part, this basically works at two levels in Apple's software. Apple calls the two levels peak and pop. I think it has some more sensitivity than that, but it's not clear at this point how much pressure sensitivity a 3D Touch can detect. But Apple is using these things called peaks and pops, and basically a peak allows you to kind of 3D touch or force touch. I don't know what Apple's calling the term for actually doing a 3D touch. But as you press, you get a little peek into information. So that can manifest itself in a few different ways. It could be a contextual menu popping up. It could be a preview of something sort of popping up and coming into play. And then as you're looking at that little peak of information, if you press harder, then you can pop that data into view, either opening up, say, like a new email document, or opening up an Apple map, something like that. So you might see an address, for example, in a email message or a text message. You could 3D press on that to get a little peek, maybe see the address on a map. And then if you actually want to launch into the Maps application and get some directions, you could press a little bit harder and get a pop. So that's kind of how that works. And it does work along with that new Taptic engine that's in the iPhone. And you get a little sort of haptic feedback when you're doing either a peek or a pop. 10 milliseconds for a peek and 15 milliseconds for a pop. So not only when you press do you get the visual cues, but you also get a little tactile cue that you're activating the feature. And like I said, a lot of the peaks to me feel like contextual menus, so they really kind of keep you from having to do extra taps or swipes to accomplish a task. So another example would be, say, you want to send a tweet. Kind of the old way might be that you double tap the home button, you find your Twitter app that's sitting there in the background, you tap on the Twitter app to open up the Twitter app, you tap on the start a new tweet button, and you start typing. With the new way, with 3D Touch, you can do something like simply press on your Twitter app's icon, get a little peek contextual menu, and it'll have a few different options, one of them being, hey, start a new tweet. And then you just drag down, you pop open, you know, press a little bit harder on the new tweet option, and it will pop open a new sheet, and you can actually send your tweet that way. So it's going to save a lot of sort of what Apple called back and forth. Like, and it is smart about sort of what you're doing in the context of, you know, what the application is. So, you know, within an application, it might do something a little bit different, and it's going to be implemented in a different bunch of different ways. And Rene Ritchie did point out over at iMore, too, again, with the pressure sensitivity, that the harder you press in something like Notes, in an application like Notes, when you're drawing, you can actually get thicker or thinner lines. So there is kind of some other ways to use it beyond just the peaks and the pops. And there is APIs that are being made available to developers. So developers are going to be able to build 3D Touch features into their applications. We saw a demo of it with respect to some games. So games might use 3D Touch to activate certain features, to do certain interactions a little bit differently than maybe, you know, like a spreadsheet application might. So it's going to be really interesting to see how developers put this feature together. The one concern that I have, and I've read about a little bit as well, is the discoverability of 3D Touch. Like, how do you know if an application is using 3D Touch and where it's using 3D Touch? Because it's really hidden until you actually force touch on the screen. And we've seen the same problem with force touch, right? On the Apple Watch, you sometimes don't know where to use it. And you find that you're kind of just poking around at your device, like constantly pushing on things, seeing if, hey, does this have a 3D touch feature or a force touch feature? But I think that concern is a short-term one. I think that, you know, it's about learning kind of a language, a new language of a gesture language. And we went through this when we had even pinch and zoom and swipe and all these things. And they quickly, very quickly became just part of the language of working with an iOS device. And this is kind of one of those new things. And I think as people and developers and work with it and discover it and figure out how to use it and what it's good for and what it's not good for, we're going to eventually sort of develop this language and we'll all come to understand it. And it will start to make sense where, you know, hey, this is probably a place where the developer has implemented 3D touch because it would make sense in this location. And it's that at that point you'll kind of interact with it. And I think actually this is the feature that could get people to buy a new iPhone, because I think it's going to be really a time-saving feature. I think there's going to be a lot of interesting things happening with it. To me, it's kind of the sleeper feature, because when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, that's not that big a deal. It's kind of like a long press. You know, really what's different about that? And the more now that I've dug into it and learned about the technology and learned about the ways that it can be implemented and used, I think this is going to be a little bit of a game changer. I don't think it's a huge game changer, but I think it is a game changer. And I think you're going to see other companies try to replicate it. And just based on how Apple has said this is implemented, and they've been working on this for years, and there's a lot of nuances to this that I think make it really work as well as it does. And I think a lot of Apple's competitors are going to look at this and think they can just replicate it. And I think it's going to be very hard to replicate the full experience and ease of use and all that sort of stuff with this feature. I think they're going to be surprised by that. So I don't expect this to to be as well implemented by Apple's competitors as they've done it here. But time will tell on that. And then the other kind of cool key feature that Apple showed off with the iPhones was something called Live Photos. So now when you launch the camera app, it's going to start capturing images in the background and sort of looping through them. And then when you go to actually snap a photo, it's going to capture frames for 1.5 seconds before and 1.5 seconds after your shot. Now, when it goes into your camera roll, you're just going to see the image that you took. But when you actually 3D touch on the image, if it was shot with the Live Photos feature enabled, and the feature is enabled by default, you can actually go in and turn the setting off if you don't like it. But when you 3D touch on it, it comes to life and starts looping through the little 3-second video, kind of like an animated GIF. Actually, under the hood, what's happening is they're creating a Live Photos format bundle. It's actually a bundle of JPEG images or images that are based on the JPEG file format, and then they are stored along with it. And Apple did say they're not storing the entire image. They're kind of just storing the differences, so it's not going to take up as much space as you might think, although there's a report out that says it does take about double the space of just a single JPEG. But still, you got to imagine it's keeping several frames of images, and it's not video. It actually is still images, and it's pretty cool. A lot of people are calling this kind of the Harry Potter feature, and it will kind of come to life as you force or 3D touch on it, and you'll be able to use them as live wallpaper on your phone. So if you shot a really great one, you can set that up as live wallpaper. I'm hoping it's something that you can put as a on your Apple Watch, because the Apple Watch kind of has that feature for photos. And Apple does say that it's going to have support for it in OS 9 in the Photos application, and also in OS 10 El Capitan. So you'll be able to look at these in the Photos application. And if you send them to someone, you'll still be able to actually even send them to someone who doesn't have support for live photos, and they'll just get the single image, again, because it's just something that's built into the JPEG file. And again, you can disable the feature if you don't really like it. There's a little yellow concentric ring icon in the camera app application. And Apple, again, is opening this up to third-party developers. They can build support for this within their own applications as well. So I expect this feature to be implemented pretty widely. I think it would be a feature that would look great in iBook author books. So I would expect to see it there, you know, the ability to kind of tap on it. And again, I think it's going to be something people are going to be able to use very creatively. It'd be interesting to see if it's something that you could create for just like still images or drawings or something like that without actually using the camera, if you could actually create these things in software. I don't really know. But that's Live Photos. And as you're hearing this, the iPhone has gone on sale, the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. They went on sale Friday, September 11th, or actually Saturday, September 12th at 12:01 a.m. Victor Cahiao and I got on a new service called Blab at blab.im. I'll have links to this in the show notes, direct links to it. There's a video, and we just hung out and talked about our buying experience. But I'll just tell you, for my part, it went incredibly smoothly this time around. I think it went very smoothly for most people. There doesn't seem to be a lot of sellouts going on, so I probably could have even gotten up this morning and just ordered my phone. Phones are being delivered on Friday the 25th, September 25th. So if you order one now, the one exception, at least as of this morning, was 128 gigabyte iPhone 6S in the, or 6S Plus in the Rose Gold. The Rose Gold models basically seem to be the ones that are selling out the most quickly for whatever reason. And the iPhone 6S Plus seems to be selling out more quickly at this point than the 6S. So depending upon what model you want, you may or may not be able to get it on the 25th. They're starting to slip back to the 2 to 3 week time frame. But availability generally seems to be pretty good, not like the last time we had iPhones. And I know many of you will ask me, when did you order? I ended up going with a 128 gigabyte iPhone 6S. Yes, I'm getting rid of my Plus, and I could not be happier. You know, I bless all of you who like the big phone. I gave it a full year shot. I really tried to use it and see if it would grow on me. if I would like it. But all I discovered was that I am a person, I really like to have my phone in my pocket, and just constantly having to take it out and set it on the table or put it in my upper shirt pocket, it really was just enough of an inconvenience that it offset all of the benefits it had. I'm going to be sad to lose the optical image stabilization. The big screen is really nice in some instances, you know, in a pinch for watching movies, but I really prefer watching movies on my iPad. So happy to see it go. I'm going to get the new, smaller iPhone, and I couldn't be happier. And I did get the AppleCare Plus, and this is the first time I'm not getting a space gray iPhone. I'm actually getting the white gold version, or the gold version rather, with the white. And it's the first time I'm going to have a white iPhone. So I'll have to see if I like that. And I got that along with the midnight blue leather case, which is a new color leather case. Apple has some new leather case colors that came out. And the reason I wanted that combo is Apple showed off the stainless steel gold sport version with a midnight blue sport band, I think when they made the announcement. And I thought it looked gorgeous, and I thought that would look great in an iPhone combination as well. So I'm going to give that a try, and I'm really looking forward to it. But hey, what did you order? Did you order a new phone? What did you think of the new announcements? Give me some feedback. Let me know. Maccast@gmail.com. Now let's talk about Apple TV. Apple TV, new Apple TV. This thing is awesome. You know, I said they have the reality distortion field. And yes, some things have come to light that have, you know, broken through that. But overall, I still think these are a bunch of great products. Like, I am really excited about everything that Apple announced. You know, even the iPhones, even though I think they were the least compelling, they're still a really good update for the iPhones. Apple TV, however, this is a whole new ballgame. So just running down the specs real quick, A8, 64-bit processor. It's believed that it has 1 gigabyte of RAM. That would be double from the current version, which is believed to have 512, or I think known to have 512 megabytes. The form factor itself is slightly taller. It's 1.4 inches, and I think it was just under an inch before, so added about a half an inch to the height. 3.9 inches wide by 3.9 inches high. HDMI 1.4, 802.11 AC with MIMO. Still 10/100 base T Ethernet, Bluetooth 4.0. And as we're going through the specs, every other Apple product that was announced is Bluetooth 4.2. For some reason, the Apple TV is still on Bluetooth 4.0. It does have a built-in IR receiver. They changed out the micro USB port. It now has USB-C. That's this little service port. So if you ever need to dock it into your Mac, you're going to have a USB-C to, you know, standard USB cable. And it's coming in two different sizes. And this was a bit of a surprise, because the rumors had thought it was going to be 8 gigabytes and 16 gigabytes. No, it's actually 32 gigabytes for $149 US, or 64 gigabytes for $199 US. So quite a bit of storage in there. And there's a good reason for that. And that is apps. You're going to have the ability to have apps on this. Apple put a really focus saying that they really think the future of television is apps, which is a little bit funny, because we've had TVs and other platforms that have had apps forever. And you could even argue that the channels that are on the current Apple TV are actually also just apps. But hey, that's how Apple's spinning this one. And my sense is that they're spinning it that way because they're struggling with the TV service, right? And I think this is actually really smart. And I wouldn't be surprised if they continue to just go down the app route, if they haven't fully given up on the TV service. I don't think they have. I think they're still wanting to get a light TV service with streaming TV and live TV and all that stuff for one set price. I think they're still pursuing that. But because they've just hit so many roadblocks, I think they're seeing that if we just have apps, just like we have on the iOS devices, so that all these channels can have their content on the Apple TV, this is going to be an easier way to go. And another advantage of that is Apple doesn't end up competing with a lot of the people they want to get content from. And that is what I think could be Apple's biggest problem, is even if they got the TV subscription thing in place, then people who have apps and are already dealing direct with their customers, they're going to be a little miffed, right? What is to keep say, Netflix there, especially if Apple goes into producing its own shows, like has been rumored. So if Apple starts producing its own shows and own content for its own channel, it's going to be competing with Netflix and Hulu. And why would Netflix or Hulu want to be part of Apple's Apple TV package? Right. So they could have some problems there. So if they just keep it open and let any developer who wants to make an app for the Apple TV bring it there, I think that's a good route to go. But getting back to the hardware, one thing significant is this version did drop the digital optical out port, which I guess is concerning for some people maybe who have older equipment. I think the rationale here is most of your audio stuff now can be hooked up over the HDMI. So more people are moving that route, so it sort of simplifies the connections a little bit. Somebody mentioned not being able to connect headphones, but I didn't know that you could connect headphones to the digital optical out port. Maybe there's a special weird cable, but I don't think that's a big deal. Hopefully Apple's going to add support for Bluetooth headphones to the Apple TV, because I don't know about you, but if I'm listening at night, a lot of times not everybody in my house wants to hear the Apple TV. Now, there is one nice feature that's in there that's going to help with that, and we'll get to that in a second. But another thing on the audio end of things, this version of the Apple TV is finally supporting Dolby Digital 7.1 sound. So prior to this, we had 5.1. Now we're up to 7.1. So thank goodness for that. Another killer feature of the Apple TV is the new Siri remote. So Siri is a big part of the new Apple TV. And to utilize that, you have the Siri remote, which has dual microphones. It does have a touchpad, just like was rumored at the top. Actually a clicky touchpad, glass touchpad. So think very much like the touchpad on the MacBook Pro before they moved to this new Force Touch one. Uses Bluetooth 4.0, as I mentioned already, but it still does have an IR transmitter, and that's so that you can control the volume on receivers or other kinds of equipment that are in your house. And then other buttons that are on the remote, you have a menu button, a home button, Siri button, a dedicated Siri button for activating Siri, play, pause, and then a volume buttons. So you can control the volume on a TV or receiver via the IR. But if you have a television set that supports the new HDMI, I guess it's not really new, but if it supports HDMI CEC, or what's called Consumer Electronics Control, if your TV supports that, then you'll also, with the Apple Siri remote, be able to power on your TV, switch to the correct input, and control the volume through that. So the remote's becoming a little bit more versatile. It does have a built-in battery, so no more having to change out the button cell battery. And Apple claims that that battery will last for 3 months of typical usage, and it charges via a lightning connector on the bottom of the remote. One thing I was a little bit disappointed about is I don't think it's going to be super convenient to plug your remote in to a lightning cable. Hopefully it'll charge up pretty quickly. And Apple does include the lightning cable. It'd be nice if they had just had a little dock that you could set up and just put the remote in, for two reasons. One, it would make it less likely that you'd lose the remote. You just put it back on its docking cradle. It'd be cool if that was even built into the top of the Apple TV. I don't know why they couldn't have a little slot in the top of the Apple TV with a little lightning connector, and it just docks right there into the top. Come to think of it, I just thought of that now. That'd be a really easy way to handle it. I'm sure there'll be some third-party accessories or something that do that. But good-looking remote. It's glass trackpad on the front, metal on the back. Very nice-looking remote. And I like the fact that it's a little bit larger, maybe less prone to being lost. It also does have an accelerometer and a gyroscope in it for motion control, and that relates to some of the gaming features. It does have gaming features. You can use it. And you can still use your iPhones and iPod Touches and those sorts of things as additional remotes. And as far as playback goes, it still is only an HD playback device. There is no 4K support or playback. And this is another thing that surprised me. I really thought we were going to get 4K. I get why Apple's not doing it. Most of the arguments are there's just not a lot of 4K content out there right now. But the thing is that's the way things are going. People are getting 4K television sets now. And the fact that Apple lets you shoot 4K on the new iPhones and then not play it back on the Apple TV seems very odd to me. That is where it sort of fell apart. I figured if we got shooting of 4K with the iPhone, that Apple would be supporting playback of 4K on the Apple TV, but not the case this time around. So this version of the Apple TV comes with a whole brand new operating system called tvOS. It is different than what is currently on the Apple TV, although Craig Federighi says it's 95% the same as iOS, with just some modifications to the interface layer to support the new remote and displaying on a large TV screen. He says that Apple views iOS, OS X, tvOS, and watchOS as all being built on kind of the same core framework of ideas, and he says they should kind of stay in sync as they're updated over time. So a lot of cross-pollination of ideas and concepts and interface. And I think that extends into the new UI that is in tvOS. It's very much cleaned up. It's got more of an OS X Yosemite kind of look. It's all white instead of dark now. You've got these cool parallax buttons. So as you actually roll over the buttons, they're kind of layered, made up of up to five separate layers that developers can put into their little icon. And so as you tilt your thumb or put your thumb across the trackpad, depending upon where it is, it kind of tilts the edges of those little tiles, the little buttons, and really makes them look really, really cool. It's a cool visual effect. And gives this little 3D element to the Apple TV interface. And they added, as I said, Siri support across the board, which includes a new contextual universal search. So now when you do a search with Siri, say, show me some comedies, or show me movies that are action movies, or show me movies that are James Bond films. And this was sort of in the demo. She can go into all of your different sources and find those things. Right now, it works across iTunes, Netflix, Hulu, Showtime, and HBO. But Apple says that they're going to be adding more. I'm also hoping that developers can add support through their apps through an API and just expose the metadata, and then as you add more apps to the Apple TV, you can search more locations. But it's not clear if that's going to be possible at this point, or if that's something that Apple's going to want to actually control access to. Another cool thing with Siri is, as you're watching TV shows, you can call up additional information like stocks or weather or sports scores, those sorts of things. You get information on actors. You can say, hey, who's in this movie? And she'll slide up a little panel from the bottom while the movie is playing, and you can view that content. And then you can pull up on that to pause the movie and drill in deeper and interact with the information, and then slide that back down. There's a cool kind of skip back feature. Have you ever been watching a movie and somebody says something and you didn't quite catch what they said? Maybe the sound's a little off, or they have a thick accent or something like that. You can say, Siri, what did they say? And Siri will automatically jump back 15 seconds and then also throw on the closed captioning for just the period of playback, so you can actually read and maybe rehear what the person said. So there's a lot of cool thought that went into the Siri features. And again, it's very contextual. So if you're kind of drilling into get more information, or you're trying to find something, so you can start out saying, hey, Siri, I want to watch an action movie. And she'll go in and try and find action movies. And then you can say, yeah, but I really want one that has Vin Diesel in it. And then she'll pull up Vin Diesel movies. And, you know, just the movie about cars. I don't know if that would work, you know, to find Fast and Furious or something like that. But you get the point, right? So she can kind of build on the things that you're saying for a much more natural way of interacting and finding stuff. And the demos looked great. So hopefully it works as well as we saw in the demos. A lot of the hands-on area people said that, you know, when it was a little bit more quiet in the room, it worked really well. When there was a lot of noise in the room, it was a little bit iffier. But overall, I think most people were very impressed with it. Question about the tvOS that's come up since the event is that a lot of people wanted to know, is tvOS going to be available on my third-gen Apple TV or earlier Apple TVs? And the answer is looking like no. It's only going to be available on the new fourth-generation Apple TV. And then the feature that I was mentioning earlier about, you know, if you've ever been watching a movie and had kind of trouble hearing the voice, there is a new enhanced speech feature on this Apple TV, which is going to up the sound for voices and then will lower background noises and music for nighttime watching. And it's something you can activate with Siri as well. So you can kind of get Siri to put it in enhanced speech mode. So if you are watching at night and maybe other family members are asleep and you're worried about disturbing them, but you still want to be able to hear the dialogue in the movie, you can enable that feature. And I know that's a feature that's on some other devices, like my Sonos has that feature, but it's really, really handy, and it's nice to see that coming to the Apple TV. So as I said, one of the big things about the Apple TV is the App Store and the games. So there is a built-in App Store. You're going to be able to get apps and games, and Apple really thinks this is how people are going to get new TV experiences on the device. They already have apps for ABC and Disney, HBO, Hulu, and Showtime all redid their apps for at launch. I think Netflix as well. Apple says you'll be able to buy full season subscription plans for sports packages with NBA, NHL, and MLB. And oh, wow. You know, I'm not even a sports fan, but the MLB At Bat app they demoed on stage. If you didn't see that part of the presentation of the keynote, go back and watch it. It looks amazing. You have all of the games. You're able to pull up a game. You can get all kinds of stats, including real time, what's going on, you know, with the current status of that game. You can get notification alerts of other games that you might want to be keeping track of. And when those notifications come up, you can click on them and then get picture in picture. So if you've got two games going at the same time, you can flip back and forth between them. If you're a sports person, I think this thing's going to be amazing. And again, it's done through the MLB At Bat app on the Apple TV. And cool for those of you who are Plex fans, Plex announced that they will have an app on the Apple TV. They didn't give a date on when it will be available, but finally we're going to be able to get Plex on Apple TV as well. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that. So XBMC, all of those things are coming to Apple TV, and I think this is what Apple's vision is you're going to be able to really expand the capabilities and personalize your Apple TV for the way that you watch or want to interact with programming and content and stuff like that. I don't know what's happening on the podcast side of things, but it would be nice even to see third-party podcast apps with maybe more support and more features than what Apple has built in to their application. So nice enhancement to the Apple TV, and I think it's really going to up the game. A lot of people are pointing out that it's really Apple kind of catching up with some of the other set-top boxes out there, and I would tend to agree with that, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, especially if you're an Apple fan like me and you live in the Apple universe. I know I want a device that's going to integrate with everything that I'm using, and Apple TV is really the only choice. The other set-top boxes, you know, I've looked into, but they've never been compelling because most of my content is in iTunes and I need to be able to use it from there. As I mentioned earlier, as far as playing games goes, the remote does double as a controller. Basically, you turn it sideways and then the trackpad becomes your D controller, and then you click on the touchpad to act as an A button and use the play pause button as your B button. Macworld says that the Apple TV will support up to four remotes, but iMore says that currently you can't pair more than one Apple Siri remote. Although during the demo, it looked like they had the two guys when they were doing the Crossy Road demo, they were doing head-to-head play, and they were each using an Apple TV or Apple Siri remote. So I would think you'd be able to attach more Apple remotes to it, but right now it's sounding like Apple's official word is that you can't. You can use third-party made-for-eye gaming controllers with it, and you can also use your iPhones and iPads as additional controllers. So you will have multiplay game support up to four people at a time. According to Macworld, they say additional Siri remotes will cost $79 US. It's a pretty cool remote. It's got a lot of technology in there, but that seems a little pricey to me for a remote. Maybe it's just because I'm used to paying $29 or whatever it is for the current Apple TV remote. And because you do have motion controllers and accelerometers, you can do Wii-style kind of gaming, and Apple actually showed a sports game from the folks at Harmonix doing that. And that immediately brought up my concern. Well, are they going to have the same problem as the Wii did, where people were throwing the Wiimote through their TV screens and you had to get a leash? Well, actually, yes, Apple's already thought about it. There is an optional, what Apple is calling, remote loop strap, and it looks like it attaches to the Lightning connector. It looks like it's just like basically a, not a Lightning cable, but, you know, just a Lightning connector that straps in and then has a little loop strap on it that you could attach to your remote. Seems like if you threw the remote hard enough, it would become disconnected from the Lightning cable. So I don't know if there's some trick where they're getting it to lock in or something like that. But Macworld says those straps are going to cost $13 US. Again, seems a little pricey to me. And I'm going out on a limb and predicting that in a couple months, there will be a class action lawsuit. People are going to be up in arms because they're throwing their Siri remotes through their Apple through their LCDs, and Apple will have to just start bundling the strap in for free and probably send straps to people who didn't have them already. It'll be kind of like like it was with the bumpers in an antenna gate, where I remember Apple had to give everybody like a free case to deal with antenna gate. I think we're going to have I don't know what you call it, Siri remote gate. No, I don't know. I can't think of a, you think of a creative name for that and email it to me and we'll figure it out. Maybe we can hedge our bets and get ahead of the media this time around. Apple TV apps would be limited to 200 megabytes of on-device storage. So each app is going to have to be pretty small. And that got me thinking, well, what about, you know, those big game apps that can be, you know, several gigabytes in size? And it sounds like the way that's going to work is additional content needs to be dynamically downloaded from the App Store via iOS's on-demand resources functionality, with user data being stored in CloudKit. So apps are going to have to actually dynamically add and remove content like levels and cutscenes, tutorials. So any additional content outside the 200 megabytes is going to have to be pulled in on demand and then used and then kind of thrown away or thrown out. User data, if it needs to persist, needs to go through CloudKit. So that'll go up, I would assume, into your iCloud account for storing like your high score and your progress and all those sorts of things. So developers are going to have to be a little bit more creative. The only concern there is that if you're on a slow internet connection, especially if you're doing like a really high-end game with a lot of 3D assets and cutscenes and stuff like that, you could have really long load screens. So hopefully developers will figure creative ways to do that. I know there's other like Android streaming gaming boxes and stuff out there right now, and those seem to work fairly well. Although I have heard in some of those reviews that, you know, one of the problems is load times are really, really slow compared to, say, like a dedicated console. So I don't think this, you know, the Apple TV is there to upset dedicated console systems. I don't think it's going to take on, you know, the Sony PlayStation or the Xbox or anything like that. This is more about casual gaming. This is more about, you know, having your iOS games on your big TV, things like that. And I think it's going to be pretty popular, just like games were on the iPad and the iPhone. Apple Music and Photos are also part of the new Apple TV. And then Apple also showed off these flyover style screensavers. I don't know about you, but I don't even use the current screensavers on my Apple TV, but these look cool, I guess, if you want to leave your TV on all the time, which is funny because it's a little bit of a dichotomy with Apple's environmental efforts, in my opinion. Like, hey, leave your TV on so you can look at our cool screensavers. And they are really cool. I mean, they're these slow motion shots of like San Francisco and different cities and things like that. And they even have that feature built in where it'll detect the time of day. And during the day, it's going to show daytime shots. And at nighttime, it'll show a nighttime version of the same scenes. And they look beautiful. I just don't know if that's a feature that's going to be used by a whole lot of people. So it's going to be available in late October, Apple said, in 80 countries. Now, something that, again, came out afterward is, they didn't mention this, is that the Siri remote is only going to work in 8 countries at launch: Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, Spain, the UK, and the United States. All the other countries are not going to have the Siri features built into the Apple TV, and Apple is saying that that version, the version in those countries, is going to be bundled with simply the Apple TV remote. Now, based on the looks of it, it looks like it's the same exact remote with all the same buttons and things like that. It's not clear whether or not it has the mics or not. I would assume it does. And it even has the Siri button, but apparently pressing the Siri button in those countries, in the version sold in those countries, will just bring up a text search screen. So you'll still be able to do the universal searching, but you're going to have to do it through a text box since Siri won't be built in. And I would imagine that's just a matter of doing the translations and things like that, is why Apple made that decision. But whether or not Siri will be enabled later in those countries, or if you'll have to purchase new hardware to get Siri, really isn't clear at this point. So we'll try and get an answer on that, because I'm sure some of you are wondering, hey, when is it going to be available in my country, or is it going to ever be available? And Apple will have to kind of maybe answer that. So we'll keep pushing on them. And if I see anything or hear anything, I will be sure to let you know. But my thoughts on the Apple TV, you know, I think the UI is really nice. I do wish it pushed more of, you know, like my personal content forward. It's still that, you know, hybrid mix of some of my content and then a lot of Apple's content in terms of iTunes and stuff like that. And I get it. You know, they're trying to sell content. They're trying to, you know, push sales and stuff like that. I'm just worried, again, with features like now Universal Search, that it's going to be pushing more of the content that I don't own than actually the content that I do own or the services that I do subscribe to. So trying to kind of upsell me on services, say like Hulu and Showtime, which I don't currently subscribe to. And Apple may have some success with that, because I'm already considering, hey, maybe I want to have Hulu for some more TV content. And if I start seeing that in my search results, it's like, hey, you asked for these cool comedies and here's one that you don't have because you don't have Hulu. You know, and I think that's part of the whole game here. I'm just hoping it's not too much in your face, or that maybe you can tweak it or fine tune it a little bit more so that it's more focused on your content. On the gaming side of things, I am positive that the games are going to be way more for casual gamers and not for gaming diehards. No one's going to be dropping their console for an Apple TV if that's the kind of gaming that you like to do. Games are, you know, also something offered by other platforms, but I think Apple has a little bit of an edge in this because they are going to allow developers to create games for the Apple TV as universal apps. So just like if you get a universal app now, you can play it on your iPhone or your iPad. Developers can now add Apple TV to that, and so a lot of your existing games, you might come to find out, already work on your Apple TV because the developers just enabled the Apple TV version as part of the universal package for that. And if you're worried about, well, now I'm going to get, you know, sort of giant Apple TV graphics and things like that on my iPhone version of my game, iOS 9 is bringing in something called app thinning. So developers can now build their apps in a way where only the assets required for the device that you're installing it on get installed. So they become much smaller in terms of their storage sizes and things like that. And so you'll be able to take advantage of that. I'm curious with games, how things are going to work with multiple remotes. And more importantly, once you've paired multiple remotes, if you can pair multiple Apple TV remotes, how does that work inside a family when you've got four remotes, everybody has a remote, and you're trying to decide what you're going to watch on TV, and everybody's like fighting over the interface? I would imagine there needs to be a master remote, one remote to rule them all. But only time will tell, because we don't really know. As soon as it's out and as soon as we can maybe get more remotes for it, we'll find out. I guess that's probably why Rene Ritchie is right, that for right now, Apple just says you can only pair one Apple TV remote, and that's kind of the main remote. Another thing that they demoed was home shopping apps. And, you know, that's not my thing. It might not be my thing, but I could imagine it would be very popular among lots of people. And again, I think this is very much like the Apple Watch and apps, or your iPhone and apps. It's going to be very personalized to your family and the kinds of things that you're into and what you like to do. You know, you're going to have apps that make sense for you. I think developers are going to have to figure out what apps and experiences make sense for an Apple TV. I expect initially that there's going to be a lot of bad apps and experiences while they kind of figure that out. I think there's going to be a lot of junkware. There's going to be a lot of apps where you try them out and you're like, this makes no sense on the TV. And there's going to be a learning process on this, but it's still exciting. You know, I think we're going to see a lot of developers jumping on the platform. And again, developers are super creative. They figure out really neat ways and unexpected ways to figure that, to, you know, use these devices and use this technology. And I think Apple's become very familiar with that, and that's why they're you know, willing to open it up like this, because they're going to create experiences that even Apple didn't think of, and some amazing ones. So I'm really looking forward to it. And just to kind of address the people who are out there saying, well, now Apple is playing catch up with other set-top boxes. You know, again, I think they are, but there is a big difference with this Apple TV through the experience, through the integration. You know, if you're invested in the Apple ecosystem, the experience you're going to get on the Apple TV is going to far outweigh anything that you can cobble together with other products. So I'm very excited about the Apple TV update, if you can't tell already. And others are as well. Now, there's already an unboxing of the Apple TV, and this one shocked me. There's some guy named Andrew Edwards, and I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com if you haven't seen it yet, who somehow already managed to get his hands on an Apple TV. Before the Wall Street Journal, you know, before Engadget, before NextWeb, all these other major outlets where you would expect and unbox it. I'm not familiar with the guy's work. He has about 26,000 YouTube subscribers, so not anybody I was super familiar with or have heard of before. Maybe he's bigger in YouTube channels, and that's how he was able to get his hands on one. But looks amazing. First unboxing there, and check it out if you want at the link in the show notes at maccast.com. So that's Apple TV. Super excited about it and looking forward to getting mine at the end of October. So on to the iPad Pro. For me, the most surprising announcement of the event. Not surprising because I didn't think it was coming. I actually did think Apple was going to announce the iPad Pro at this event. I was just not expecting to be blown away by it. I thought it would be a great product. I thought it would be something that would be interesting. I thought it would be something that was for people who were not me. And boy, was I wrong. And for me, I think it's really about the accessories. So we'll talk about the accessories in a second. But the iPad Pro itself, 12.9-inch Retina display. The thing is huge. I mean, Tim Cook brought it out and he was holding it. It is kind of massive. They made a good point to point out that the width of the iPad Pro is the same height as the iPad Air. So if you have an iPad Air, you know, hold it up and then turn it on its side. And that's how, you know, that's how wide the iPad Pro is. And 12.9 inches on the angle, a resolution of 2732 by 2048. That's 5.6 million pixels for a pixel density of 265 pixels per inch. It's not 4K, but it can edit 4K video. Apple was quick to point that out. They showed that you could edit three streams of 4K video in iMovie. As far as, you know, when you have it in landscape view, even though it is the same height as a iPad Air, you can't quite fit two iPad Air's screens side by side in its landscape display. Almost. The portrait width of an iPad Air is 1,536 pixels, so that doesn't quite squeeze into 2,732, but pretty darn close. You can almost get two full screens side by side. Another cool feature that is in the iPad Pro screen, and as far as saving battery life, is it's the first product to have a variable refresh rate. So as stuff is not moving around the screen as much, it can actually drop the refresh rate from 60 frames per second down to 30 frames per second, and that saves a little bit on battery power. It's 6.9 millimeters thick, which is just slightly thicker than the iPad Air, and it weighs 1.57 pounds, which sounds a little bit heavy. I think they kind of compared it to the original iPad, about the same weight as that. And if you remember kind of holding that in one hand, a lot of the reviewers said, yeah, you can hold this thing in one hand, but you're not going to want to hold it in one hand for too long. It gets a little bit unwieldy, especially being kind of top heavy, because you're going to want to kind of grab it at the bottom, and it's going to want to tip backwards. I mean, the thing is a beast. It's pretty darn big. It's also a beast on the inside. It's got Apple's newest A9X processor. Apple's calling it a desktop class processor. They say it's 1.8 times faster than the iPad Air's A8X. It has an M9 motion coprocessor. Apple says that the A9X will actually outperform 80% of the laptops sold in the last 12 months in CPU performance and 90% of them in graphics performance. But you have to remember the PC market, there's a lot of cheap low-end PCs out there. So it's going to be, you know, on the lower end of the desktop performance scale. You know, I'm thinking something comparable in terms of performance when we start seeing benchmarks of maybe like the MacBook, the Intel Core M processor range, you know, running at like 1.1, 1.2 gigahertz, somewhere in that range. Adobe put out a PR release that seemed to leak the amount of RAM that's in it. Apple typically doesn't talk about that, and the press release that Adobe put out was pulled. But it's looking like it has 4 gigabytes of RAM, which is double the iPad Air's 2 gigabytes. It has faster flash storage and a faster controller for controlling that flash storage. Apple says that will let you quickly open even the largest files. And again, that's what allows you to do things like edit 3-4K video sources, you know, getting that data on and off the storage, as well as just being able to process it with the GPU and CPU. All that stuff adds up to performance, right? The audio system, it does have 4 speakers, like the rumors thought. And a cool thing here is that they will adjust depending upon the orientation of the device. So, you know, if you've grabbed it down at the lower corner and you're kind of covering up the sound on the lower corner, it's going to compensate so that it kind of gives you consistent loudness and sound, so you're not getting kind of muffling as you're flipping it around and moving it and stuff like that. And internally, it looks like it's got some serious kind of baffles in there for the speakers as well. So in the hands-on demo area, they were saying the speakers can get pretty darn loud, about 3 times louder than the current iPods, or iPads rather. Same battery life we come to expect from an iPad, 10 hours of battery life, which is pretty impressive. The cameras look to be the same, like the same ones that are on the current generation of iPad Air, 8 megapixel EyeSight camera and a 1.2 megapixel FaceTime camera. Touch ID, they didn't mention if it has Touch ID 2 or the original Touch ID, and there was no mention of NFC. Remember, one of the rumors was that it might have NFC built in so that you could use the iPad Pro as like a payment terminal for Apple Pay, but they didn't talk about that at all, so I don't think NFC is in there. 802.11ac MIMO, Bluetooth 4.2, and LTE, but the 150 megabit per second LTE, so again, just like the iPad Air, not like the new iPhones. And it's available in 3 colors, silver, gold, and space gray. No rose gold color for the iPad Pro. Still has a lightning connector, no USB-C. And, you know, again, lightning connector on the iPhone. I was really surprised. I thought Apple might move all of the products over to USB-C moving forward, but we haven't seen that transition yet. So it looks like they're still sticking with the lightning connector, at least for iOS devices. It's going to be shipping in November, and pricing starts at $799 US for a 32 gigabyte Wi-Fi model of the iPad Pro, $949 for 128 gigabyte Wi-Fi, and if you want the cellular, you have to go with 128 gigabyte model, the highest priced one at $1,079. Personally, you know, I just do Wi-Fi on my iPads, and that's because I can have tethering on my phone, and that's worked great for me. So all in all, very exciting hardware, but it gets even better. Where I got really excited about it was with the accessories. So Apple's going to have a new keyboard cover accessory, the Apple Smart Keyboard Cover. This is a keyboard. It's in a custom woven fabric, Apple says, something they specifically designed and built for themselves, because that's what they always do. A little bit of marketing fluff here. You know, the fabric looks great. The reviewers that had hands-on time with it said it feels great. So I expect it to be a really, really nice cover. It has a smart connector port on the side of the iPad. So on one of the landscape sides, there's these 3 little connector dots, and they magnetically connect to the smart keyboard cover and provide power and data. So it's not a Bluetooth keyboard. It actually physically connects and gets its power from the iPad Pro. And the connector is actually already opened up to third-party developers. As a matter of fact, it sounds like Logitech actually helped Apple develop the technology, and Logitech has announced that they are going to have a keyboard accessory for the iPad Pro that will connect and use the same connector. And it's looking like it possibly could be used for other things, because it is bidirectional, both on power and data. So I'm thinking, you know, you could probably get music accessories, like a piano keyboard, maybe some drum pads, maybe you could get some DJ controls. I think we're going to see that port being used for a number of different third-party accessories. You do still have a Lightning connector. That's not the only connector. You still have a Lightning connector on the bottom side for, or edge, depending upon, I guess, how you're holding it, for doing syncing and charging and all that sort of stuff. But the keyboard itself does have full-sized keys using the same butterfly design technology that Apple developed for the new MacBook. So expect the kind of key travel and feel of it to feel very much like the new MacBook, which for me, when I first tried it, felt a little bit shallow. But I've read a lot of reviews, people have been using it, and they say it just takes a little bit of getting used to. But generally, after that transition period, most people who are using that keyboard really, really like it. So I expect it to feel really, really good. And it works like a smart cover. So if you're looking at it, it looks like the smart cover is now. You can kind of fold it around, make it into a stand for watching movies, and then you can flip it around another way and sort of fold it out so it stands up and you can use the keyboard. Basically, the keyboard's kind of on an extra flap that folds in. And my only complaint about that is I looked at an Apple Insider hands-on video, and when it was kind of sitting with its back down and the cover closed and on top, the keyboard kind of creates this little extra bump, and that bump kind of sticks up in the middle a little bit. So it didn't seem to kind of totally go flat. Now, it's not the actual final product, so I don't know if what they were showing at the demo area was kind of not completely done yet. But I think, for those of us who are a little bit OCD about those sorts of things and the fit and finish, that might be a little bit bothersome, but overall, it looks really great. Review I read said it looked like it was really designed for being used on a table. I think Jason Snell made that comment, and not so much on your lap. So it's really meant to kind of be when you're using the keyboard on a hard surface. It's going to be kind of hard to use it in that flipped around, sort of folded origami mode, sitting on your lap. And the keyboard cover is only going to work with the iPad Pro because it needs that special connector, and it's actually really sized for that because it is also doubling as a cover, and it doesn't have Bluetooth connectivity. So you're not going to be able to buy one and use it with your iPad Air or something like that. And because of the iPad Pro size, they also mentioned that the on-screen keyboard is getting pretty close to full size anyway. So if you're not going to opt for the smart keyboard cover, you're still going to be able to get pretty good typing on an iPad Pro. The keyboard cover itself is an additional cost. It's $169 US and is going to be available in November along with the iPad Pro. So the keyboard's really exciting. And then on top of that, we have the new Apple Pencil. Apple is doing a stylus. And the key, I think, with doing a stylus on an iPad is that, we have a lot of third-party styluses out there now. The trouble with them is the latency. You kind of draw something, and the stroke that you're drawing will often, depending upon how fast you're going, have to catch up. And so Apple claims with the Apple Pencil that there is imperceptible latency, that it collects twice as many data points as when you use your finger. They've really fine-tuned it and tweaked it specifically for the iPad Pro. They claim that you can get down to one pixel level of precision, so very precise lines and control. It has the ability to detect pressure that's built into the tip of the Apple Pencil. It can also detect angle and orientation. It has two tilt sensors on it, and so it can tell how you're holding the pen and at what angle. It's not clear how much pressure sensitivity it has built into it. They didn't talk about that in terms of a spec, so we don't know yet. 12 hours of battery life. It is super thin. It's thin and long. It looks really reminiscent of an actual pencil, even down to the little magnetic cap on the end that is removable. It looks a little bit like an eraser, and you pop that off, and under there is a built-in Lightning connector. So you can plug it into an iPad or plug it into a charger to recharge the pen. And the pen will last, I think I just said this, 12 hours of battery life. TechCrunch reported that if you run out of battery and you just need a little extra juice, plug it into the iPad Pro for 15 seconds and you will get 30 minutes of charge. So it fast charges right back up. and you can get back to drawing. So that's pretty cool. It does come with some additional pencil tips when you buy it, because those will wear down and wear out over time. A rep told one of the people in the hands-on area that it works kind of like refilling a ballpoint pen. So I'd imagine it pulls out and probably has a little kind of, I don't know, stick or insert that kind of goes into the end of the pen. And Apple, of course, will be selling extra replacements of the tips. It's not clear, you know, how quickly or how long a tip is expected to last, but they are replaceable. Right out of the box, it's going to be working in Notes, Mail, Paper by 53, Procreate. It is open to third-party apps. There is a developer kit and developer APIs. And basically, it sounds like the way it works is developers are going to get input based on the sensors. So you'll get, you know, the pressure data and the angle and orientation data. And then it's sort of up to the software to determine how to react to that input. And that's actually pretty cool, because that means different apps are going to be able to react differently. And I would imagine the natural thing is you think about drawing and writing apps when you're thinking about a stylus. But there could be some other really creative applications in games, in maybe music apps, so I can kind of use the stylus on the screen and when I'm in a certain area, depending on how hard I press or how I tilt the pen back and forth, I get different angles, different tones, those sorts of things, because you could imagine sort of like a synthesizer app working with the stylus. So I think, again, developers are going to take this, they're going to get really creative with it, and they're going to find some creative uses that maybe Apple didn't even think about. The pencil will only work with the iPad Pro. A lot of people had asked, you know, am I going to be able to get the pencil and use it with other devices? It's not clear if you'll have limited functionality, like maybe you'd be able to use it as just a dumb stylus. I don't think you're going to get pressure sensitivity. I don't think you're going to get the angle features, but maybe you could just draw on another iPad with it. But it's really, to get the most use out of it, you're going to want to pair it up with an iPad Pro. The pencil itself costs $99. Again, it's going to be available in November along with the iPad Pro. And just wanted to comment on one thing, because, and I immediately thought of this, actually, you know, during the keynote, I think when Apple announced the pencil, there was a collective chuckle from the crowd. And it's because any of us who were around in 2007 when Apple announced the iPhone remember Steve Jobs just lambasting a stylus. You know, I think the direct quote was, "Who wants a stylus? You have to get them, you have to put them away, and you lose them. Yuck." Right? That was kind of how I think I got that inflection right. And then also later when they announced the iPad, he said, "It's like we said on the iPad, if you see a stylus, you blew it." And that was in 2010. So Jobs was never really big on styluses. And this is coming back to haunt Tim Cook's Apple, because, hey, here's Apple's calling it a pencil, but here's really a stylus, right? And I think when you really think about this, the comment during the iPhone launch, I think, still really holds true. A stylus does not make much sense for a phone. Maybe the new iPhone 6S Plus, but certainly not for that teeny tiny 3.5-inch phone that we got, right? There wasn't a lot to do with it. It didn't have a lot of accuracy to the touchscreen. I mean, you could only get so accurate. So your finger was a much more appropriate input device. And even going through to today, I mean, look, the Galaxy Note 5S Pen controversy, where you insert it backwards and it gets stuck and breaks your device. Styluses are a little bit of a problem, and you do lose them. I've lost styluses, so I have some for my iPads, and they go missing. So these are legitimate issues. The second thing is that for the iPad, a stylus is not going to be the main way of interacting with a tablet, right? Still, in many ways, you're going to be using your finger. This is an accessory that is built for specific tasks and for specific reasons. And again, you don't see Apple marketing this even at the iPad Air. This is marketed at a big, large, gorgeous tablet, the iPad Pro. And it really is a different kind of device. And so it makes a little bit more sense. And it's also, of course, why the pencil is an optional accessory. It's not something that's shipping with the device, because there's going to be a lot of people that don't need it or won't want it. And Apple's kind of not forcing it on anybody. So, you know, this idea that, oh, Apple said styluses were stupid and we never need a stylus. Apple always kind of reverses their mind when, or changes their mind when it makes sense to. And I do think this time around, The pencil makes a lot of sense, especially for the iPad Pro, and I'm super excited about it. Just real quickly, so that's the iPad Pro and all the accessories. We also did get an update to the iPad Mini, just a very small one. They're basically making a mini iPad Air 2. So it kind of has all the same specs as the iPad Air 2. It's going to support the new iOS multitasking features, so things like slide over and the picture-in-picture and the split view are all going to be capable on the new iPad Mini 4. And the reason for that is they've upped the processor to a version of the A8X, so you got 60% faster graphics performance. You're also going to get the M8 motion coprocessor. It's 6.1 millimeters, so thin, so it's thinner and about 30 grams lighter than the prior version. Has an 8-megabyte EyeSight camera, capable of 120 frames per second video at 720p, so you get slow motion video on there. And it's going to sell at $399 for the 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi version, $499 for the 64 gigabyte, and $599 for the 128 gigabyte. Add $130 US to each one of those models for the cellular versions. Apple has gotten rid of the iPad Mini 3, but they are going to keep around the iPad Mini 2, and you'll be able to buy one of those starting at $269. So that was all the updates for the iPads. So, you know, my thoughts on that, I kind of already shared with you. You might not believe it, but I actually now really want, or maybe you believe it now after hearing me gush, I really want an iPad Pro, and I was not expecting that to happen at all. And I want all the accessories. I want the pencil. I don't know how much I'm actually going to really use the pencil, but I'm super excited about the keyboard. And the reason being is I'm at a place now where I don't like really taking my MacBook Pro on the road with me unless I absolutely have to. And there's only a few instances where I absolutely have to, and that would be either I'm coding, and I don't know yet if the iPad Pro is going to be able to be something that I can actually really do my web programming on. It is something, though, that I think I may be able to get away podcasting on and doing editing in GarageBand on the iPad and using my mobile audio rig that I have. And also, I know I'm going to be able, especially with a keyboard, to be able to do my research and my notes and all my prep for the show. And a lot of times where my iPad Air has fallen short is I can kind of do the reading and the research and the organization of articles. But when I sit down to actually write out the show notes, while I can do it on the iPad Air, it's not really convenient. And I think the lack of a keyboard is one of those key features. Also, the inability to kind of multitask very easily, to kind of have to constantly be double tapping and jumping between the different apps is always, it just takes a lot longer. I can do it, but the workflow is just not as efficient. And I think the iPad Pro is really going to solve a lot of those problems. So I'm planning on buying one and setting down a challenge for myself. And of course, you'll be able to follow along with me on MacCast after I get it. But I'm going to see if I can turn my MacBook Pro into a desktop. And I'm going to go a month only when I leave the house taking my iPhone and the iPad Pro and see if that really works. And I think for me, it actually might. And so that comes down to a big question I've been getting since the event from you is, you know, where does this fit? How does this fit? Because you look at the MacBook Air, the smaller MacBook Airs, and you look at the MacBook, and when you price out with the keyboard and everything else, the pricing of the iPad Pro is very similar to an iPad Air or a MacBook. So the decision becomes, you know, which one do I get? Which is the portable computing platform? And I think that's really not the way you need to ask the question. You need to ask, what type of person am I? What is the experience that I prefer? Am I a laptop person or am I a tablet top person? Yeah, and I just coined a new term, tablet top. So you can use that if you want. Maybe that's terrible. I don't know. But, you know, the idea of a tablet kind of notebook. And I think it's about specific users and their preferences. Which experience do you like better? Do you prefer the iOS experience and that way of working? And in terms of what can you do on an iPad Pro versus a MacBook, things are a little bit blurred, but the experiences are still very different. You know, you're not working the same way on a notebook as you are on an iPad and vice versa. Sure, they can both surf the web, they can run Office apps, they can do email, they can edit video, they can run Photoshop, but how you interact and how you do those sorts of tasks are very different. And so you kind of have to decide, what do I prefer? Do I prefer one versus the other? And, you know, how you work with them is very, very different and even could be generational. You know, so one way to answer this question is, you know, are you old or are you young? And I think, you know, without trying to be offensive, I think that's just sort of a reality, right? Us old fogies, we grew up with a mouse and keyboard and we're kind of used to that way of interacting. My kids don't even know hardly a mouse and keyboard. They know how to use a mouse and keyboard. But I mean, in general, I was thinking about this the other day. The only mouse in my entire house is the one that is hooked up to my Mac. My wife's has the Magic Trackpad, and my kids work on iPads most of the time. So they're used to swipe and gestures and virtual keyboards and all those sorts of things. And so the iPad Pro, I think, is very appealing to that generation and to kids getting into college. I mean, could you imagine if you had an iPad Pro in college to take to class? I think it would be, you know, a preferred way of a lot of students for taking notes and keeping up with their schedules and doing stuff in class. So for me, I'm really seduced by this idea of really, really ultra portability, a device that I carry in my hand, not in a laptop bag. And I think even if I had a MacBook Air or a MacBook, I'd still be carrying it in some sort of satchel. My iPad, I literally have the smart cover and I just pick it up off my desk and go. And just that level of convenience, I'm really looking forward to. Not having a bunch of accessories and things that I have to plug into it, just having that be the only device. And I'm going to give it a shot. I think it's going to work. who knows? We'll see. In a couple months, maybe I'm returning the thing and getting a new MacBook Air. But we're going to give it a shot. So that's all the big announcements. A few other odds and ends to kind of finish up. Apple snuck in the El Capitan release date into a little peaked email. Craig Federighi was doing the demo, and if you looked really closely when he peeked in on an email from Phil Schiller, it disclosed the release date of El Capitan. It was planted there. It was done on purpose, obviously, but September 30th is when we'll get El Capitan, if you were wondering. Apple also announced new iCloud tiers and pricing, so if you buy iCloud storage, it's about to get a little bit larger and a little bit cheaper. You can now get 50 gigabytes for 99 cents a month. And again, these are all U.S. prices. Previously, it was 20 gigabytes for 99 cents. The 200 gigabyte plan stays the same but gets dropped a buck. So $2.99 per month versus $3.99 per month. The 500 megabyte tier at $9.99 is now gone. Because now you get 1 terabyte for $9.99 per month. And that was previously $20 a month. So the new iCloud storage plans, I think, are much more in line with some of Apple's competitors. So it was good to see them make those adjustments. It's not clear when they're going to kick into place. Probably when Apple releases iOS 9, but we'll see on that. And I don't know how they're going to prorate or flip people over. We don't have a lot of details on that yet. With the new iPhones, Apple does have now color-matched lightning docks. So you can get a lightning dock that matches your iPhone. Those are going to sell for US $49. And then not related to the event, but just a couple other things that happened. We didn't see the 21.5-inch 4K iMac at the event. That was one thing that was rumored to possibly happen. It does sound like it's still coming, though. DigiTimes said that production actually has started on the 21.5-inch 4K iMac. It's expected to still launch sometime this quarter, so in the next coming months. It's expected to have a 4,096 by 2,304 pixel screen, 218 pixels per inch, basically matching the 5K iMac. And it could likely be the first Mac where we see some of Intel's new Skylake processors that were recently announced and we recently discussed here on the MacCast. And then for fans of Apple Pay who use Discover cards, Discover is coming to Apple Pay, at least in the US, it sounds like, on September 16th. And to kind of celebrate that, they're going to be giving 10% cash back on all Apple Pay purchases up to $10,000 until the end of the year. So Discover fans, you'll be able to finally use Discover with Apple Pay. But with that, that is all of the news and Apple event information I have for you this week. We're almost at a little over an hour and a half. I knew this was going to be a big show. Still got a few more things to cover. We've been talking recently about Apple Watch and, you know, what are people using Apple Watch for? What do we use it for? And for myself, I use it mostly for triaging notifications, forgetting the time. You know, who knew you'd get time from a watch? Yeah, it's actually one of the big features. Also setting timers and reminders and stuff like that. I do that very often using the Siri features. And then also messages and occasionally voicemail calls and things like that. That's kind of my main usage. And you've shared some of your usage on past episodes. But interestingly enough, Wristly did a survey of 2,000 Apple Watch owners and found some interesting things. People use it for checking notifications, the time, and complications, they say, more than they expected. And I would say that's generally true for myself. The other thing that they discovered is that people are not using it as much as they expected as a remote or for personal messages or for listening to music or podcasts. You know, I honestly haven't listened to any music or podcasts on my Apple Watch, but I didn't expect to either. Is anybody out there using it for music? I would imagine if you're exercising, maybe you're using it for music. But again, because you have to pair that with Bluetooth headphones, I think a lot of people just, when they run, tend to use wired headphones or something still, or earbuds with just being plugged into their iPhone. But, you know, what do I know? Are you using it for music? I don't think anybody's mentioned that. So I would say that probably what I've been hearing goes along with the Wristly survey, that, you know, notifications, time, complications, checking those things. Glances are something that I expected to use and don't use at all, but that's mainly because they're so dang slow, especially with third-party apps. So I think iOS 9 and native apps is really going to vastly change what we're doing with Apple Watch. And so once that hits in just a couple days here, I think this whole dynamic changes, this whole conversation changes, and we probably need to revisit it, because I have a feeling 3 months from now, when we ask this question, what are you using your Apple Watch for? The answers are going to be very, very different. So I'll be curious to find out both what I'm doing with Apple Watch and what you're doing with Apple Watch in a few months. If you're noticing that you're running out of space on your Mac hard drive, one culprit might be Apple Music. You know, we've got Apple Music in this last release of OS 10, and if you've been doing a lot of streaming with it, you could see that your hard drive space is slowly dwindling away. And that is because Apple actually caches a lot of that music so that, you know, if you go back to a track and play it again, it doesn't have to re-download it. It makes a lot of sense. But if you're like me and you listen to a lot of music on shuffle, that storage space could get eaten up pretty quickly. So I found this great tip online that mentioned where the cache was and how to clear it out. So if you looked and you're running out of space, and you may just want to go check your iTunes music cache to see how much storage space it's using up, and then clear it out. So all you have to do is quit iTunes and then go to your home folder, into the library folder, into the caches folder, and look for the com.apple.itunes folder. If you don't know how to get to your home library folder, the easiest way is hold down the option key while going to the Go menu in the Finder, and then pull down, and then you'll see the library folder. And then once you're in the library folder, again, look in caches, and then look for com.apple.itunes. And once you open that up, you can look, you can get info on it, you can see how much storage the cache is taking up. In my case, it was 3 gigabytes. And so with iTunes shut down, you can actually just delete all of those files that you find in there and then relaunch iTunes. Any of the cache files and things like that you need will be recreated. And then you can start streaming again. Just remember that it'll start to fill up over time again, and you may have to do this process all over again. Right now, Apple doesn't kind of give us any controls or any way to kind of set limits on this. And I don't even know, honestly, what the limits are. But I just thought that was a helpful tip. So if you're, you know, running low on storage and you need a place to clear out, this is another one of those places that you can go check and maybe gain back a little bit of extra storage. Okay, and then the last thing that I have for you today, and this is going to be a pretty big discussion, is we've got OS X El Capitan coming. We know it's going to come out on September 30th. And I've had more than a few of you ask me to rerun down how to do a clean install of the operating system, because typically the way most of us install an OS update now is it comes out, you go to the App Store, right? You download the installer and you just run it. You run it right over top of your current operating system. And the reason the question of how do I do a clean install comes up is because really there's no longer, it's really not longer possible to kind of boot up from a disk. We used to have disks, right? And you'd stick the disk in and you'd boot up from the disk and then you could erase the internal hard drive and you could clean install the operating system. Well, now Apple has the recovery partition, which is actually on the same drive as your boot drive. So even if you boot into that, you can't erase it because you're actually already booted on the same volume. And so how do we actually now do a clean install in this world where we get our operating system through the App Store and through App Update and we have this recovery partition? And the first thing I'll ask back to you is, do you really need to do a clean install? 90% of the time, I believe now, with the way the operating system is set up and sort of cleans up after itself and takes care of things, the answer is no, you don't really need to do a clean install. An over-the-top install is perfectly fine. You really don't have to worry about it too much anymore. I really think OS X has become pretty robust and the operating system is pretty stable. It does a pretty good job of managing itself. And if you aren't really having any issues or problems with your Mac, if you haven't noticed anything where you're getting a lot of spinning beach balls or just weird stuff happening, then go ahead, download the new OS when you're ready. Install it right over the top. Of course, you know my motto, make sure that you have backups before you do any of this. And then go on your merry way. Enjoy your new operating system. The one caveat to that, too, is, check and make sure before you run your software update that your critical applications are supported on the new operating system. Because they aren't always supported on day one. And you know all this stuff already. This isn't anything really new. But then, so if 90% of the time the answer is no, what about the 10% of us who maybe should do a clean install? How do we know if we should do a clean install? Well, if you've been having a lot of issues with your Mac and none of the normal fixes or troubleshooting has worked, like, the typical chicken waving stuff, repair permissions, run Onyx and Cocktail, clean out your caches, look for corrupt files, all these things that we normally do, clear off space on your hard drive if it's really full. If none of those traditional fixes have worked for you, or maybe if you're like me and you've been doing over-the-top upgrades for the last 4 or 5 releases, it might just be time to clean things out. Or maybe you just want to force kind of a spring cleaning. You want to force yourself to kind of make an assessment of your system. This is a good way to do it. Say, I'm going to clean install this time around. I'm going to reinstall all my applications from scratch. I'm not going to bring them all back on because I know that it's been, 4 or 5 years since I've done this, and I've got apps in there that I haven't used since then. So why do I want to put that stuff, have that stuff continue to live on my operating system? So it's a good way to clean out your system. So how do you do it? Well, it really all begins with some prep, some cleanup, some verification, doing some house cleaning. I like to make sure that I clean up, archive, and remove any old junk or files. Basically, I go a lot through my home folder. And I look at the movies folder, the music folder. I look at iTunes. I look at my photos and just want to get my, anything that's going to be on my boot volume, I want kind of cleaned off. I don't want to carry that along with the new operating system and with the new upgrade. And so, look in there because after the clean install, you're going to restore your user folder and your documents folder and all that stuff back. And so you want to clean it out beforehand because if you don't, you're going to have to still clean it up after the fact. So it's just a good time to do it, I think. And then once you've kind of cleaned all that out, use Disk Utility to do repair permissions and also verify and check your hard drive. Make sure there's no issues with your hard drive because you're going to install a clean brand new operating system on it. If it's about to go into hardware failure, now's probably a pretty good time to replace it. And just know, and we talked about this on the show, this is the last time you're probably ever going to have to do repair permissions if you're upgrading to OS X El Capitan because El Capitan has sort of repair permissions built into it every time you do a software update or an install. So it's going to kind of take care of it for you automatically. So do a little house cleaning first and foremost. Secondly, backup. 3 backups, right? Make sure that your entire system is backed up in at least two places, preferably three locations. If you have archive files, that's great too. But just make sure you have those backups. And then also make sure that those backups are working. You may want to verify the hard drives if you're using external hard drives. Make sure there's no problems with your backup drives. And also make sure, just spot check and make sure you can recover some files. So a lot of people have to often ask me, what does that mean? I literally just go into my, you know, say my clone backups and go into various folders at different levels and stuff like that and see if I can copy files off. With Time Machine, I just go into my Time Machine volume and see if I can recover some older files in different locations and things like that. Go into two or three different locations, make sure I can get them back. And I know that's not a perfect check, but at least it's kind of a spot check and you can just verify, yeah, I can, my backups are working and I can get those. A couple times what I found is that, oh, I had turned off, you know, like Time Machine backups because I was doing something else and I wanted the processor cycles and I forgot to turn it back on. So I don't have a current Time Machine backup. And in those cases, you'll want to just rerun or manually run your Time Machine. Make sure that you have a backup, that your automated clone backup did run last night and you didn't get any errors. That's another good check. Just make sure your backups are good, because ultimately we're going to erase your entire hard drive, all of your data, your operating system, everything. And you don't want to have a failed backup be the thing when you know that you end up going to when you discover everything went south. So make sure all that stuff's working. And then finally, before even doing the install, take inventory of the apps that you're going to want to put back onto your system. So I like to go through my apps folder and again, find all of those old applications that you're like not using anymore. And don't put those on the list. Only put on the list, these are the apps that I'm going to put back on, you know, back in the applications folder. And then take that list and go to a site like roaringapps.com, you know, like a roaring lion. roaringapps.com, and I'll have a link to this in the show notes at macast.com. It's a site that lists compatibility for Apple's operating systems and programs, and it's crowdsourced and things like that, so people can go in and say, yeah, I have this app, I've tried it out on El Capitan and it's working for me. And so check and make sure that all your apps are compatible, or just go to the developer's website and check with them. Make sure, hey, yeah, it is going to work when you do your upgrade. Because another horrible thing to find out is you've done the operating system upgrade and then that critical app that you need to run doesn't work anymore. And I would really advise, and I should have probably said this at the top, if you do run critical applications on your Mac, day one of an operating system release, so like September 30th, would not be the day to be upgrading your Mac. If that's the Mac that you use for work and making money and making a living, don't be upgrading that thing. Wait, you know, a couple weeks, if not a month or so, and make sure there aren't any major bugs or issues, especially with specific applications that you rely on for doing your work. Okay, so take an inventory of your applications, make sure you have that list, and then gather together any product keys, registrations, download any of the installers that you might need. Have all that stuff ready for later when you're going to be reinstalling your applications. Just make sure you have that all in one place. And so then once you've done all that, now we're ready to deal with the operating system and doing the clean install. So the first thing to do would be to download the OS X installer from the Mac App Store. So go find it, download it. It's probably going to auto-launch and want to, you know, run you into the wizard for doing the over-the-top install. At that point, quit the installer. And then you should be able to go look in the applications folder and find it. With OS X, El Capitan, it's expected it'll probably say install OS X El Capitan will be the name of the installer file, and you'll see that in your applications folder. Because what we need to do is we need to take that and we need to get it onto some sort of bootable volume, probably a USB stick or an SD card. So make sure you have a blank USB stick or SD card that's at least 8 gigabytes in size. So you'll have that, you've downloaded the installer, and then you're going to need to follow Apple's instructions for running the create install media command. And if you're afraid of terminal, you may need to back out now, because this is a terminal command that you can run to create a bootable version of OS X installer on a USB stick or an SD card. I will have a link to the full instructions at support.apple.com. It's very important that you follow them exactly. They have some commands that you can copy and paste into the command line. Right now, I will just warn you, the commands are all built for OS X Mavericks and OS X Yosemite. So you're going to have to go in and change the application path for the installer for El Capitan. But that shouldn't be too hard. It should be pretty clear how you actually do that. If it's not clear to you, ask somebody or email me. I can try and help you out with it. But you're not going to have to do this until September 30th anyway. So by that time, there'll probably be some additional instructions and things like that. But follow those instructions. And at the end of it, you should end up with a bootable USB or flash drive with the OS X installer on it. And there is a great third-party application called DiskMaker X that will let you build installers from OS X installers or build bootable disks from OS X installers. Right now, it only works through OS X Yosemite, so I don't think it's been updated for OS X El Capitan yet. But hopefully later it will be, because that's really the easiest way to create these bootable disks and how I prefer. But right now, if you want to do an El Capitan one, you've got to use Apple's command line tool. And again, I'll have a link to how to do that in the show notes at maccast.com. So once you've got all your prep done, you've got your bootable USB stick, then you want to disconnect all external drives, devices, hardware, everything except a mouse and keyboard. That is, if you still use a wired mouse and keyboard. I don't think many people do anymore. But point is you don't want anything extra sort of connected up to your Mac when you're doing your software update and your clean install. So disconnect all that and then plug in your USB or your flash drive into your Mac and then restart or reboot or boot up your Mac while holding down the Option key. And then select the drive with the OS X El Capitan installer. And so you'll boot off that. That's the one that you just created. And then when that installer boots up, you should see the OS X utilities screen. On there, you're going to select Disk Utility. And then you're going to use the Disk Utility to erase and format your Mac's hard drive. And you're going to want to format it in the Mac OS X Extended Journaled format. So reformat the drive. That's going to erase everything. You got your backups, right? You've got at least three backups. You've verified that. And you really want three, because the minute that you erase your hard drive, you now have two backups, right? As opposed to three. So you're losing one for a little while. You definitely want to have at least two, because if you only have one backup, and you erase your hard drive, the original one, you now have zero backups. And if anything happened to that drive that has all of your data on it, then you are SOL. And that's not a good place to be in. So reformat the drive and then quit Disk Utility. And that'll put you back into the OS X Utilities screen. And then now from there, you're going to choose Reinstall OS X. You're going to pick the Mac disk that you just erased, and then you're going to click Install. And you're going to install a fresh copy of the operating system onto your freshly formatted drive. And that's the clean install part, right? When it reboots, when the process gets done and it reboots and your Mac starts up, all you're going to have is a Mac with an operating system on it. And that is it. As it reboots, it's going to put you into the setup process. And when you get to the transfer information screen, you want to attach your backup drive, either your clone drive or your Time Machine drive. In the options, you're going to say you want to backup from another disk, and then you'll either select the Time Machine or the clone drive as your source, and then you'll select the information that you want to transfer back onto your Mac. And what you're going to want to transfer back is the users folder, so you're going to check that on. Applications, you're going to uncheck, because we're going to clean install the applications. Settings, you can go ahead and check that to bring back the settings. And then other files and folders, also turn that on. So we're going to bring back everything except the applications. And remember, we cleaned out the users folder beforehand, so that should be all nice and clean, and we shouldn't have any issues with that. So then transfer all your data and wait for that to finish. And then you should be able to boot into your Mac and then start installing applications. But before that, you probably want to open up the Mac App Store and go to the software update button and check for any software updates, late breaking software updates to the operating system. Install any of those. There'll probably be some reboots. And then you're gonna start through what I call the application install dance, and that is just going through one by one and installing your applications. And I like to start with the Mac App Store because that's the quickest and easiest. You just go to your purchased area and you start installing all of those apps that you repurchased. And I like to start with the iWork and the iLife apps. So if you're running like Pages and Numbers and Keynote, I usually install those. If you use GarageBand, you're going to install that. Photos and Mail and all those other applications should already be installed as part of the operating system, so you don't need to worry about those. But, you know, GarageBand if you use it. And then start going through any third-party apps that are in the Mac App Store. Get all of those installed. Launch them up. Make sure that they're working and they're running and all that sort of thing. And then you can start clean installing your third-party apps. And don't forget about menu items and system preferences and drivers for any printers or peripherals that you might have that you need to get installed. And if you've installed any command line or developer tools, don't forget to put those back on there as well. And don't forget about the data. I always get in trouble because being a web developer, I have like MySQL running and MySQL databases. I always have to remember that I go in and make sure I export those and back those up before I erase my entire hard drive, and then I have to come back and restore all those things. So don't forget about those sort of under the hood things that you don't even remember are on your operating system. So this does take a little bit of memory recall to set this stuff up. But then once you've done all that, again, verify that all your critical apps are able to launch and that they're working, and you should have a new, good, clean installed operating system, and you should be good to go. And that's pretty much it. I mean, it sounds a little bit complicated. It's more time consuming, I think, than complicated. Then the last thing, of course, is reset up all your backups. Don't forget to do that. And one thing that I like to do, if you can afford it, get a new drive for your cloned backup. Get a brand new drive. And the reason I recommend doing this is because that allows you to keep around your old cloned backup. I like to keep mine around for about a month or so, at least a month, maybe a couple months, just as like an added insurance. Like, did I forget to bring something back over, or did something come back over and it was corrupt? I can kind of go back to that cloned drive. But then reattach your Time Machine drive. I think it should ask you if you want to use the disk and as for a Time Machine disk, and if you want to pick up from the, you know, from the time point that you already had. And I usually say yes to that. You know, go ahead and start backing up from this point forward. In some cases, I actually do completely erase my Time Machine drive and start completely over. This just depends on if I'm worried about retaining the history or not, or if I just want to kind of move forward. And, you know, that choice is really up to you. And then also I reset up any of my clone backup, usually, like I said, with a new drive. And just something to note at this point, SuperDuper, if you're a SuperDuper user like I am, I haven't heard anything about them and OS X El Capitan compatibility. I don't think they've announced that they are ready yet, but they do have about a month to go, so wait and see. But Carbon Copy Cloner users, Bombitch already did announce that they have been updated and will support El Capitan on day one. So if you use that, that is a good way to go. And then make sure you reset up any of your offline backups as well. So if you use CrashPlan, you know, reinstall that software, or you use, you know, Backblaze or whatever you might use, make sure that's up and running and working again. And then you should be good to go. You should have a whole new clean operating system. You're doing your backups, everything that you need to do, and you should be able to enjoy your new operating system on a clean environment. So that's how you do it, or that's at least how I do it. If you have other hints or tips or tricks for reinstalling the operating system, be sure to let us know. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this supersized episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhones and iPads, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And they're also a great way to get some cash for maybe a new iPad Pro, maybe a new iPhone. Check it out. Get your offer at gazelle.com. And TunnelBear, really simple VPN app to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can try it today for free. Just head to tunnelbear.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They are at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. And you can find them at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me an audio comment or an email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Leave voicemail there. You're also welcome to leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or on Google Plus, google.com/plusMacCast, and that's plus as in the plus symbol. And like I said, I did a quick video chat with Victor Cahiao following us buying, you know, staying up to the wee hours of the morning and buying our new iPhone 6S's. If you'd like to see that video, you can check it out at blab.im/MacCast. That's blab.im/MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.